are invited to speak to you today. So, he waited, his body motionless, poised, ever alert for a movement, a rustling of grass, a disturbance of leaves. How long had he been sat here, waiting? Hours by now must have passed as the sun was tracing its arc, the light shifting and changing. But he didn't mind waiting. He was used to it, waiting and watching. For they were his science, to observe, note and collect. His patience for his quarry almost boundless. So accustomed are we to reject what the eye sees in nature, so dull and dead we have become as a result. As zoologist, naturalist and Darwinian, countless field hours disclose to Hugh Cott the complexity of form, pattern and adaptive coloration in nature. He was a student of nature's concealment, its obscurity. For instance, how the smooth cylindrical body of the snake is flattened to the earth by its colouring, the ringed plover scattered to the ground by its useful pattern feathers alone. But today, it seemed his waiting was in vain. The partridge nest, amongst the grass and leaves, tucked in tight under the hedgerow, was empty. Had she abandoned it? Had she sensed his presence and was observing him, waiting for his departure? So with a few final clicks of his camera, Hugh Cott stopped waiting, stopped watching, and rose to leave with his hind. But later she did reveal herself to him, the partridge he'd been waiting for all those observant hours. In the dark room, she began slowly to take form, feather by feather, to reveal herself. Come and enjoy nature with me by means of what is only a picture. I may be able to remind you of beauties you have not fully perceived. And there she sat, body motionless, poised, ever alert. Squat and still, her body in the nest became the nest, by the hedgerow and as hedgerow. She was a shadowland of interweaving, interpenetrating patterns, colours and forms, an entwining of ecological relations. As he was the student, she had provided him with a masterclass in concealment, in observing the obscure. This anecdote about Hugh Cott, a Cambridge zoologist, proficient wildlife photographer and gifted graphic artist, was offered by a former colleague of his to me as a means to reveal something of Cott's character, namely his lack of sense of humour. His colleague said he realised when he developed the photographs later that the bird had been there all the time. She'd just been too well camouflaged for him to see her. I thought this was very funny and started laughing, but he hadn't been telling us a joke. We'd been perfectly serious. But Cott's partridge is offered up here to you to reveal that for Cott, in his study of biological camouflage, patient, painstaking observation was his most rigorous scientific method. He discovered animals to be the masters of the obscurity. Hours of observing them in their natural environments led him to understand that through near perfect aesthetic adaptations, they could evade exposure and capture. Cott recognised that animals melt into the backdrop through the techniques of cryptic coloration, form and patterning, the art of camouflage. And therefore, this paper will explore one scientist's efforts, his experiences of studying animals and looking for camouflage in the field, to grasp the art and nature of biological camouflage. Cott devoted years to this research throughout the 1920s and well into the 1950s. From his close study of animal bodies and their techniques of camouflage, he discovered that there was often a disjuncture between material reality and what was actually observed. Vision, he realised, is produced through a relationship between physics, physiology and psychology. What happens in the world, the physiological reaction that occurs within the eye, and then what sense the brain makes of this information. Hence, as he wrote, most of us make mental reservations based upon long years of experience, and we reject the evidence of the senses. Leaves we know are green in summer, not golden. And unless we are especially observant or specially trained, we refuse to see that the distant firs are pale grey, or that the snow on the hills is blue when it lies in shade and warmly tinted or bathed in sunlight. That indeed it may be almost any tint except the white which we think it is. Experience has taken much of the colour and variety out of life, and we go on our way, almost unconscious of the real appearance of visual signs. So further to this, Koch proposed that the process by which we recognise and interpret the visual world around us is fourfold. Firstly, an object is observed as separate from its surroundings by its colour, which differs in depth and hue. Secondly, an object is revealed by its relief. Light and shade disclose to the eye texture. Thirdly, an object is not bounded by outlines. Its form is exposed by its contour, which divides the area from where it is from the area where it is not in the visual field. And fourthly, the shadows cast by an object render it conspicuous from its background. He proclaimed, actually, we see nothing but flat stains of colour, variously shaded and variously shaped. And so from this, he recognised that prey animals need to outwit this process of visuality in their predator, and therefore possible capture. And they conceal themselves with the techniques of cryptic coloration, patterning, and behaviour. And he identified that to this end, animals then employ four fundamental methods. Firstly, colour resemblance, whereby feathers, fur, skin, or scales are similar in hue to their natural surroundings, if you're thinking of the sticking set. Secondly, obliterative shading, or counter shading, which abolishes the appearance of roundness by graduating shading on the body from dark on top to white on the underneath. And we can think of mice, deer, rabbits as being examples of that. And thirdly, disruptive coloration, when a superimposed pattern of starkly contrasting colours and tones blurs the outline of the body and breaks up the surface form, zebras, giraffes. And fourthly, shadow elimination, the effacement of cast shadows by cryptic behaviour, so sort of flattening the body to the ground again, if you think about how animals do that. And he reflected, now it is a very remarkable fact, and one of much significance, that these theoretical principles, together with various additional devices and instincts, are those actually found to operate in nature, whereby different animals, fishes and wildfowl, toads and tree frogs, dabs and crabs, cats and caterpillars, and innumerable others are rendered so extraordinarily difficult to recognise when seen in their natural surroundings. And this research and the workings and undermining of visuality in nature was to form the core of Koch's most seminal contribution to studies of camouflage, his 1940 book, Adaptive Coloration in Animals, which to this day remains an authoritative text on the subject. And by examining Koch's fieldwork, it is possible to begin to trace the practices by which he established this scientific knowledge. Due to the essentially visual nature of his science, Koch relied upon recording and analysing the different techniques of camouflage employed across various species and in various environments. Looking at animals, as Koch discovered, was actually a very embodied science. It was key to Koch's field science that he too, like the animals he sought to observe, became a part of the scene, a co-dweller, a small proportion of background that should remain unnoticed. And it is Koch's how-to guide of Heidwilden, I can't see too clearly here, that offers an insight into the knowledge and labour required in undertaking this task. He wrote, in a country where natives are expert at fieldcraft, there is no need to travel encumbered with a prefabricated hide. With local labour and local material, a hide can be erected at short notice. With long experience of waiting and watching hides overlooking crocodile rookeries, I have found it that it is a mistake to economise in space. And Koch explained how hide building also required becoming familiar with the local topography and the character of the surrounding wildlife. When settling on an agreeable spot for a hide, a key factor was an easy escape route because, as he wrote, one must be prepared for visitors, such as hippo or elephant, that may approach from any direction. It is useful to have knowledge of a climbable tree nearby. He also recommended taking an umbrella with you into the field so you could scare off any wildlife that was advancing towards you by opening it. So once a suitably roomy hide was constructed, adjacent to an easily climbable tree, the work in the field could begin. And Lawrence and Chapin have considered how scientific bodies are regarded as part of an instrumental exploration of the world. Studying animals' bodies required Koch to employ his own, in particular his eyes, as Dupré has said, as a tool for knowing, as a tool for asking questions, as a tool to create a relation that provides new knowledge. But as he knew so well, as the partridge had skillfully taught him, the eye can be so easily fooled. and thus technology had the ability to further this task. He wrote, students of animal behaviour, as well as ecologists and others, seem to have increasingly felt the desirability of using photographs to record their observation and to illustrate their papers. The combined use of eye and camera could produce a permanent documentation of the environment precisely and in great detail. Therefore, as Dupré has stated, the scientific experience is, so to speak, an instrument-body hybrid. Indeed, when properly used, the camera discloses, in a way unrivaled by any other medium, a world of surprising beauty in common things, and a good photographic record will have pictorial qualities as well as technical merit and scientific interest. The camera became a technological extension of the human optic in the art of observing nature. It became an essential tool for scientific endeavour, but it was also an artistic device to prize open nature to reveal some of its concealed splendours. With the camera, he wrote, it is possible to display the hidden and intricate beauty of surfaces right outside the provenance of painting and sculpture. And it is Koch's report of an expedition to the lower Amazon undertaken in the early 1920s, which reveals in more depth this mix of artistic and scientific engagement with nature, his field practice and poetics. The report included Koch's description of the connection and emotional response provoked in the field. He mingles scientific writing with lyrical prose in an attempt to convey the embodied experience of being in the field. Silence reigns here, and a dense roof of foliage darkens the forest with a perpetual gloom, which few rays of sunlight can penetrate. The oppressive atmosphere, the sombre stillness, the incredible grandeur and solemnity of the scene all impress the traveller with a sense of wonder and admiration, not unmixed with awe. This is nature's tropical masterpiece, the primeval forest. So Koch captures the vibrancy of witnessing nature, but also the plurality of individual experience. For him, field sites were not only experienced through the scientific perspective, but were places that blurred the scientist with the odd traveller and the romantic artist, sites that mingled some of his multiple selves. And this mirrors Klug and Kohler's suggestion that field sites are ambiguous places where boundaries are porous, easily breached and transgressed, rendering them potentially very creative places. Reflecting upon his time in the lower Amazon, Koch pushes the parameters of the field site, extending them to the very experience of beyond fixed locations, including travelling to and through places, a process he felt that sharpened his observations. Opportunities for travel are greater today than ever before. With less discomfort and difficulty, we can go faster and further. But speed and distance are only a means to an end. The essence of travel is not in hurrying from place to place. Its reward comes through the enlargement of our capacity for appreciation. The successful traveller is more than a mere spectator. He feels part of the soil and scene. Outram explains how natural history and knowledge gathering is inseparable from the movement through space, inseparable then from bodily involvement. And Koch demonstrates this as he became corporeally connected to nature through the process of travelling to the sites of research, which helped him inhabit environments and more fruitfully study camouflage in nature. Koch's field observations were not only captured and recorded by the camera lens or in the text of his field notebooks, he also documented them in his technical illustrations, describing these as halfway between a thing and a thought, between a recording of fact and a revealing of experience. These drawings, Koch felt, in some ways were more illuminating than field photography because the real work, a sort of hidden asset that goes into the drawing, comes not from the hand, but from the heart. These drawings of animals displaying camouflage in their natural environments also obliquely sketch Koch and his science. It is through close study of his art that some of the haze surrounding his figure lifts and he more firmly takes form. Koch's illustrations are distinctive because of the meticulous detail. Since Koch's scientific interest lay in understanding the texture and tone of biological camouflage techniques, his drawings are characterised by those features. Through pen and ink, Koch communicates his appreciation, admiration, but also wonder for nature. Each illustration draws likeness and type. The individual and biological life is captured, the eye, the expression, the gait and posture betray character and species behaviour, like a photograph which can capture a snapshot in time, Cott's illustrations catch and record a moment, the perpetual motion and the continual transience of life. The deftness of Cott's pen renders lines which hatch, mess, wind, cross, curl, squiggle, swirl, scratch, wave, block, sweep, weave, trail across the page. These lines, through their relations to one another, work ink into smooth, shiny beak, or give textures to feathers, whether of downy softness or waxy slick tips. Skin, fur, bone, earth, leaves, bark, moist, rough, smooth, tacky, cloying, jagged and dry. These central qualities are conjured through Cott's illustrations. His animals and landscapes are constructed through a multitude of systematic and irregular lines, which assemble to become intrinsically dynamic and temporal. Cott's art is also intrinsically spatial, conjuring onto the blank page a sense of sensuality of the places he had known, which are offered to us to observe as he did, and to see his signs take form. Thus he divulges something of himself too. These drawings at times avoid outline, containing the animal, which reflects Cott's fieldcraft, where his own light outline as scientist and artist blurred into natural environments. And this discloses that in the field, the scientific and the technological, the artistic and the emotional were never clearly distinct, but instead were folded into one another through Cott's field practices. It should be highlighted that Cott's particular approach to his science was not just in the study of wild animals, but also domestic pets, and their own adaptive colourings and patterns were also of interest to Cott. His adored cats, Monkey, Bessie, Sailor and Queenie were often the subjects of his scientific study, and the plight of Pickles the Hedgehog was recorded in comedic detail in his field notebooks. Jones discusses the messiness of our passions in our relationship with animals, and Cott's approach to scientific research offers an opportunity for witnessing such messiness at work. Animals were not but a mere object of investigation. Bodies are ripe only for dissection, study and experimentation, although at times they were. Cott approached them, wild or domestic, as lively and intriguing beings. In summary, Cott's science, the study of camouflage, looking at animals, led him to rely on his own senses and prioritise physical presence within and through places, which disclosed the sensual, emotional, technological and creative nature of fieldwork and scientific knowledge production. Further, it reveals the ways in which studying animals and their lives demands scientists' own bodies to become enrolled and altered, to engage in, at times, artistic relations with places and non-human animals in the process of grasping or exploring scientific knowledge. But further, in an attempt to study, look for and locate Cott in his scientific work on camouflage in the field, he offers some insight into the fragmentary nature of trying to understand the lives of others, human or non-human. Look as you will, yet is Cott recognised. The pageant of nature marches on. We can recognise and give names to most of the actors, but of their own makeup, their parts, and their inner lives, we still know little enough. Thank you.